I'd like to welcome you to session 135 today, which is with Ben Heaton. I'm going to read you a little bit about this presentation, and then we're going to let Ben, he's going to do his screen share so he can have his presentation ready for everybody. All right, this is session 135, which is How Useful is God's Body? Eastern versus Mormon Concepts of God. I'm so fascinated. I'm really excited about this session. Joseph Smith taught the importance of understanding the nature of God. And today we'll explore the use of the via negativa to address the concept of God or gods having a physical body, including how different human body systems might or might not be of use to an embodied God. Mr. Heaton is going to discuss related issues, including resurrected bodies, multiple gods, non-duality, and how our own body can be a vehicle in seeking to understand God and our deepest self. Ben Heaton is a free-thinking, active church member who also has a meditation practice and has studied Eastern spirituality. He is comfortable in Mormon temples, Hindu and Buddhist temples, and other sacred spaces. He's a physician that's living in San Diego. And we'd like to welcome you, Ben. All right, I'm going to ask you to unmute your speaker so everybody can hear you. And then I'm going to mute myself.
Okay. Let me see if this works here.
Yeah, you should be able to screen share, and then I'll mute after you do that. We are also going to be having a Q&A, so I will be monitoring questions in Whova, and at the about 43 minutes from now, I'll remind Ben that we're going to be doing that thing, and then we'll go from there. Go right ahead.
Okay, let's get started. As resurrected beings, would we need to breathe and eat in order to stay alive? Would our bodies freeze in the cold vacuum of outer space without a spacesuit? Does God's body have a microbiome and an immune system? Some of you may have had discussions like these back in your missionary days. These questions may sound speculative or trivial, but I'm trying to take a serious, systematic approach in seeking their significance and implications. In the past few years, my spiritual journey has led me to address these questions about the embodiment of God. Spirituality is an important part of my life, and seeking a connection with God and a deeper spiritual understanding of ultimate reality has been one of the primary objectives of my life. And just to mention that in the title, it talks about Eastern spirituality. I'm not really going doing a complete overview of that, but the concepts of Eastern spirituality will sort of filter into the talk, as you'll see. Okay. So we'll get into a more detailed discussion of the human body in just a minute, but first, to those of you who are not familiar with it, I would like to introduce the via negativa, also known as apophatic theology, negative theology, or method of subtraction. I first encountered this as a meditative practice, which involves asking ourselves questions such as, am I my body? Am I my thoughts? Am I my personality? On the deepest level, the answer to all these questions is no. And this practice helps us to identify with our deepest eternal self. We will discuss this personal method more at the end of the talk, but I realized as I was doing this practice that I could use some of the same methods to examine the nature of God. Negative theology is based on the premise that God is ineffable or beyond human understanding and description. The full majesty of God is beyond our mortal comprehension, so the idea is to seek to understand the nature of God by postulating what God is not rather than what God is. It might sound counterintuitive, but when you start to practice it, you begin to see its utility. After we subtract the attributes of God that don't seem to make sense, what is left over should be closer to ultimate truth. I approach this endeavor with a sense of humility and of seeking the deepest truth rather than with a smug certainty. I mostly want to give you some ideas to think about and let you draw your own conclusions. In this talk, when I use the term human body, I'm referring to the form and body systems of a Homo sapien, a human, whether mortal or immortal. I'll give you one of my main conclusions up front. Human bodies are designed for an Earth-like environment. That should come as to anyone. We should consider its ramifications in understanding the concept of an embodied God. In Doctrine and Covenants, section 130, verse 22, we read, "The Father has a body of flesh and bones, as tangible as man, the Son also. But the Holy Ghost has not a body of flesh and bones, but is a personage of spirit. Were it not so, the Holy Ghost could not dwell in us." The statements of Joseph Smith that was added to the DNC in 1876, not canonized in Joseph's lifetime. My purpose here is not to ridicule this teaching of Joseph. I'm taking this statement of his seriously, but also trying to give it a critical examination. Perhaps we will find both contradictions and beauty in the statement of Joseph. But we will need to address this concept in a way that considers more than just the literal answers. We will need to move past superficial binary thinking and embrace humility, uncertainty, and paradox. I hope by the end of this talk, you will be able to consider the embodiment of God in new and profound ways. The following is a statement by Robert J. Matthews about resurrected bodies, and presumably about would relate to God's body. "Resurrected bodies have size, weight, shape, and occupy space. They have every limb, joint, hair, and body part that are natural to the physical body, and they enjoy never-ending youth without sickness or pain. They are dynamic. They eat, drink, and digest food along with other functions, including metabolism and bodily warmth. They have spirit fluid in their veins instead of red blood and do not require sleep." This quote probably summarizes the general view of the LDS Church regarding resurrected bodies and presumably of God's body. The discussion going forward will mostly relate to, both an embodied God and also to the concept of us having immortal bodies in the resurrection. So how would having a body be useful to God? So first, think about your own body and how it's useful to you and to accomplish your tasks. Our human bodies have arms and hands to manipulate objects, legs for locomotion, and the five senses to perceive our environment. We use vocalizations, facial expressions, and gestures to communicate. We have organ systems to support our metabolism and our brain and nervous system to think and act. We also have a conscious awareness, which can sometimes be perceived as being independent from our body. From the LDS perspective, God's work in glory is to bring to pass the immortality and eternal life of man. Our Father and Mother in heaven are parents of our spirit bodies. God hears and answers our prayers and inspires men and women on the earth through the Holy Ghost and the light of Christ. Deeper purposes of God are probably beyond our mortal understanding. So how would the different human body structures and functions help God to accomplish these objectives? I tried to use my perspective as a physician to examine these questions. Is God's body limited to an earth-like environment like ours are? Or could an immortal body survive and thrive in outer space? If God exists outside of an earth-like environment, we will see that many of the functions of the human body would probably not be useful and might even be a hindrance. As we discuss specific body systems, I would like you to keep in mind different possibilities. Does God's body have all of our organ systems functioning the same that ours do? Do God's organ systems work somewhat like ours, but are not really necessary since he is immortal and omnipotent? Is God more like a formless spirit who can materialize in a human body at will? Does God come to earth through the process of as an avatar, such as Jesus Christ? Could it be that God's body is metaphorical or symbolic? Or can God work through all of our mortal bodies? Let's keep all these possibilities open as we move forward. So now let's go and talk specifically about the structure of the human body, which to me was kind of what started this talk and maybe the most interesting part. According to one estimate, we have 37 trillion cells in our body. This is about 100 times the number of stars in our Milky Way galaxy. Each of these cells has its own life that can exist independent of our conscious life, and each cell might even have its own spirit. Does each cell in God's body have its own individual life, like our cells? We could even ask the question, would it be theoretically possible for God to be an organ donor? Some of our cells, such as neurons, can last a lifetime, but most other cells have shorter lives. Muscle and bone cells live for decades. Red blood cells live for about 4 months, platelets for about 10 days. Some of the white blood cells in our immune system can live for over 1 year, and some live for 10 hours or less. Skin cells live for 20 to 30 days, and the cells lining our stomach and colon live for 2 to 4 days. There is a continuous process of birth and death going on inside our bodies, which is mostly unnoticed by our conscious awareness. Is God's body made up of individual cells that each have their own lives? LDS doctrine teaches that there will be no death after the resurrection. Is God's body made up of individual immortal cells or made up of something other than cells? Either way, God's body would have to be constructed and function very differently from our mortal bodies, since our bodies have a continuous birth and death of cells as part of their normal function. Let's see, there we go. Human bodies contain a large number of bacteria and other microscopic forms of life which live in our digestive tract, on our skin, and in our respiratory tract. This is called our microbiome. Estimates of the number of bacteria in our bodies range between 40 and 100 trillion, which is actually more than the number of cells in our body. This might seem kind of gross to some of you, but it's really no big deal. Bacteria in our digestive tract are vital for digestion of food. Does God have bacteria in and on his body? And does he need to have bacteria in his colon in order to digest food? A person's microbiome varies depending on the part of the world they live in. If God has a microbiome like us, would he also have bacteria from the environment around him? In its individual life, each cell of our body takes in oxygen and nutrients such as glucose and converts these into energy to power itself and releases carbon dioxide as a waste product. Do God's cells function in this way? Does God need oxygen and glucose and other nutrients in order to live like we do? Aside from the turnover of cells in our body, there's also a constant turnover of atoms and molecules. Our body composition is 60% water, and as we drink water each day, the water in our bodies will be mostly replaced every month. We take in new carbon atoms when we eat and breathe out old carbon atoms and carbon dioxide. It is estimated that our carbon atoms, which are the major building blocks of our cells, will be 98% replaced every year. There is a turnover of calcium and other atoms as well. So each year our body has a similar form, but it is actually made up of different matter and different material. Year over year, it almost completely changes. So would God's body also have a turnover of atoms like our body does? So let's discuss some of the organ systems of the body and consider how they might work in God's body if he had an immortal body. The purpose of our cardiovascular system is to provide oxygen and other nutrients to the cells in our body and to remove carbon dioxide and waste products. The heart pumps blood to the organ systems and cells. Does God need to be continually breathing air in and out and his heart beating in order to provide nutrients to his cells? We would assume that an immortal God could survive outside of an Earth-like environment. If God does not need air and his cells do not need a continuous supply of nutrients, then why would God need a heart and lungs? Of course, the heart also has the metaphorical purpose of representing God's love. Is it possible that other aspects of God's body are also metaphorical? Does God need to eat in order to survive? Do his cells need a continuous supply of glucose in order to function? If God's body circulates spirit matter rather than blood, then his cells and bodies must function very differently than ours. If God doesn't have to eat to survive, then why does he need a digestive system? Or is eating a choice? If God eats, then does he need to eliminate through the digestive and urinary systems? Our liver is a chemical factory that converts nutrients into usable energy and detoxifies chemicals which may be harmful to our body. Does God's liver work in the same way? Or if he doesn't need to eat to survive, would he even have use for a liver? So before we continue, I want to reemphasize my purpose here is not to ridicule the idea that God would have a human body, but just to consider all the facts and see what makes sense and what doesn't. We'll discuss the implications of all this later in the talk with the objective of gaining a deeper understanding of the nature of God. Our immune system helps to protect our body from harmful bacteria, viruses, parasites, and even from some cancer cells. Does God live in an environment where he is subject to infection from harmful organisms? If not, then does God need or have an immune system with cells that attack invading organisms or produce antibodies? Our brain consists of about 86 billion neurons and has an amazing capacity for thinking and memory. Even if our human brain was better utilized, a skull can only hold a finite number of neurons and synapses, and so ultimately has a limited capacity. Does God process thoughts using a physical brain with neurons? If so, would the finite size of a brain limit God's ability to think and process information? If God senses and thinks through the spirit, then why does he need a physical brain? As an aside, my meditation teacher, Phil McElmore, asked the question once, does God think? And his answer was no. God doesn't think, but rather God has an awareness of everything, which is beyond space and time. So God actually, in that sense, God would have an awareness rather than actually thinking, because thinking takes time and God is beyond time and space. What does God look like? Mortal bodies have regional differences in appearance and skin color in different parts of the world. What is God's skin color? Does God's physical appearance reflect his age as mortal bodies do? Is there any logical reason to think that God has the appearance of an Anglo-Saxon male as opposed to any other race or gender? Now let's move on to the mortal reproduction system, in which DNA is transferred from male to female in order to create new life. Is the blueprint of God's bodily structure completely contained within physical DNA? Can God only create new life by passing his DNA to another person? I don't know of anywhere in the scriptures where it is claimed that God creates either spiritual or physical life by process of passing on his DNA to another person, although this may be assumed by some people. Can God create life in ways that are different than our mortal bodies do? Many forms of life demonstrate that how gender is sometimes fluid and ambiguous, such as species of fish that can change from female to male depending on the need. Various chromosomal abnormalities demonstrate how human bodies can have ambiguous gender and identity. Is God capable of transcending gender? If God is truly omniscient, then he knows exactly what it feels like to be both a man and a woman. Christ took on all of our pain and suffering and afflictions. How could Christ take upon himself the pain and sufferings of a woman if he did not in some way experience the pain and suffering that women go through with menstruation and childbirth? Christ himself is described in both masculine and feminine terms, such as being described as a hen who gathers her chickens. Would a fixed physical gender and gender identity be limiting to an all-knowing God? How does God's body interact with the local environment around him? And how does it interact with the universe, the entire universe of space and matter? Does God have the same physical senses of sight, hearing, smell, taste, and touch that we do? Does God have eyes that have the same visual range that we do? Or can his eyes see infrared and ultraviolet light and perhaps the full electromagnetic spectrum? If so, does God's visual perception look like ours? Can he see through solid obstructions? Or does God instead perceive through the spirit rather than by light waves and photons? If this is the case, then does God really need physical eyes in order to see? Hearing requires air to transmit sound waves. Does God require an air environment in order to hear? Does he even use his physical ears for perception? Or is his hearing metaphorical through the spirit? If so, then does God need physical ears? Our nose functions by detecting molecules in our local environment. Is this how God's nose works? Our sense of...
I'm going to pause you for just a second. We're not moving through slides. Are we going to move? I'm so sorry. I know you're like me. We get really focused on things. Do you want to switch?
Mine says, does God rely on bodily senses to perceive things? Is that what you're seeing?
No, we don't see that.
It says you are screen sharing. So that's what I'm seeing.
Interesting.
So that's
so far, I am seeing just the beginning slide.
I'm sorry. Yeah, that's
no, no, it's not your fault. I'm sure it's something interesting with the screen share. I'm not sure what's going on. I'm going to mute myself, and then I will see if there's something. I'll see if there's something I can do. Please continue onward, and I will see if I can fix it on my end, okay?
That's. I'm glad you pointed that out to me.
I'm so sorry. I looked down and was like, oh, I'm not moving forward. I wonder if he isn't moving forward or if it's just us.
I'm seeing my current slide, so.
Okay, sorry about that.
That's okay. I'm just going to keep going, and maybe you can get it to work. I don't know. Because it says to me, it says I'm screen sharing, so I'm not sure what else I would do. I'll stop screen share and then start again. Let me try that.
That's a good idea. Let's see if it'll redo that.
Let's see. Let's see if this goes to the current. So, there, now, what are you seeing now?
I still just see the beginning screen.
Okay, yeah,
let me
know.
Hold on a second and make sure that, all right, give me one moment. I'm going to make sure that I'm not somehow also sharing a screen, and then we'll
let
see.
Me continue on and interrupt me if I need to do anything. Does that sound
yes,
good?
Please go right ahead. I'm so sorry, participants. I'm unfortunately new at this, and I'm working very hard to catch up on all the screen sharing.
Okay. Another important function of the human body is communication. LDS doctrine states that God often communicates through the Spirit, which is described as the light of Christ or the Holy Ghost. Since God does not require a voice that speaks through sound waves in order to communicate, could God do without vocal cords, or would he sometimes also speak in the human way? Actually, I think that communication with mortals is one function where a physical body might be very useful to God. Person-to-person communication is accomplished primarily through speaking and also through gestures, facial expressions, touch, and simply being there in physical presence. One of the most unique attributes of the Mormon God is expressed in the Book of Moses. It is the God who weeps. Even if actual tears falling from God's eyes are metaphorical and symbolic, God's physical body conveys understanding and empathy in a much more personal sense than a formless God could. In mortality, we as individuals may not have a personal physical visitation from this God, or hear the sound waves from his voice coming into our ears, see the loving concern on her face, or perhaps feel the warmth of an embrace. But even if we only communicate with this God through the telepathy of the Spirit, just knowing that God has a body like us might allow an enhanced closeness to him or her. For what purposes would a human body be useful to God? And these are the points I've tried to make so far. If God has an immortal body, then why would she need the human functions of homeostasis such as pulmonary and cardiovascular systems to distribute oxygen, a digestive system to provide nutrients, and an immune system for protection? If she doesn't really need these in order to survive, then her human body is very different from ours. Does God need legs and feet to travel and hands to manipulate objects? Does he rely on physical eyes and ears to see and hear everything? As creator of the universe, God must certainly have abilities that go far beyond a human body. Is God's body composed of trillions of cells and symbiotic bacteria that each has a life of its own? Does God's body have a continuous turnover of cells and atoms like ours does? Can God's body survive in a place that has no air or at extreme temperatures? From this discussion, it seems clear that if God has an immortal body that has the same appearance as our bodies, it must have significant differences in composition and function. If God did not have a physical body, then would that inhibit him from functioning as God? Is there anything that God could do with a human body that she would not be able to do without a body? Perhaps the main reasons I can think of why God would need a human body might be as a template to create our mortal bodies and to communicate with mortals in a more empathetic, personal, empathetic, personal way. The deepest truth is paradoxical. I don't want to have my questioning of God having a body imply that I don't see beauty and logic in divine embodiment. So in spite of all the questions that arise about God having a physical body, we should counterbalance this by appreciating the power that a human body would provide for God to communicate and empathize with mortal humans. The main point I want to make in this talk is that human bodies are designed for an earth-like environment, and the need for God having a permanent, immortal, physical human body existing outside of earth-like conditions doesn't seem to make much sense. If we are looking for the embodiment of God, maybe we should look for it here on the earth, the place where mortal humans live. So now I'm going to discuss some other issues that kind of relate to an embodied God. What are some of the ways that having a human body might be limiting to God? This question might relate to the question of how does the veil of mortality limit us and our mortal bodies? Joseph Smith said, "Could you gaze into heaven 5 minutes, you would know more than you would by reading all that was ever written on the subject." I would say that you might not learn just about heaven, but also about the concept of embodiment. Perhaps those who have had a near-death experience have had such a glimpse. Far from being limiting, many people who have had an out-of-body experience near death report having significantly enhanced abilities, including some of the following. They often encounter another person or being with whom they are able to communicate telepathically. They are able to receive and understand large amounts of information in an instant. Some report being able to see both forward and backward in three-dimensional vision. They are able to move long distances at a rapid speed through the power of their thought. They often have a reluctance to return to their mortal body and have the sensation of having to shrink or somehow squeeze to fit back into their body, once again feeling pain. Some feel that their experiences lasted for hours or days when they were only unconscious for a few minutes. They remember that they were able to experience a depth of understanding that they are unable to completely bring back to mortality. And they do gain a new perspective and meaning of life, on the meaning of life. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 20 equates with the veil of mortal flesh. The human body seems to limit rather than enhance our capabilities. What are the benefits of a mortal experience? This is not to say that there are not benefits of having a human body and experiencing mortality. Perhaps there are lessons that can only be learned in mortality. We read in Alma 34:32, "Behold, this life is the time for men to prepare to meet God. Yea, behold, the day of this life is the day for men to perform their labors." Form and teaching also includes the need for certain ordinances to be performed in a mortal body. Living a mortal life is obviously a key element in the Mormon plan of salvation. As I considered different spiritual philosophies, I think that perhaps the most important question to consider is how they address the question of what is the purpose of life and why are we here on this earth? What is the purpose of mortality? We may also feel we have a personal stake in a physical God, in having an embodied God, in the sense that an embodied God relates to the idea of our own personal resurrection. Amulek in Alma 30 states, "The spirit and body shall be reunited again in perfect form. Both limb and joint shall be restored to its proper frame, even as we now are. This mortal body is raised to an immortal body, their spirits uniting with their bodies, never to be divided, and thus the whole becoming spiritual and immortal." In the DNC, we read that the dead looked upon the long absence of their spirits from their bodies as a bondage. Mormon theology speaks of resurrection firmly as regaining a body of flesh and bones. This is not the only way to approach resurrection. Mainline Protestants focus more on the resurrection of Jesus Christ as a proof of his continued existence and his divinity than they do on each person regaining a physical body. Margaret Barker suggests that when Jesus was named and empowered as Son of God at the time of his baptism and the opening of the heavens, that this was his initial resurrection. In this sense, resurrection relates more to divinity and reuniting with God than it does to corporality. Death is difficult. It can be preceded by physical loss and pain, and is the end of our life as we currently know it. It is perhaps more difficult for those loved ones left behind. The concept of physical resurrection gives hope to overcoming this loss. Resurrection is at least a metaphor for an undoing of death and a continuance of life. As we examine the limitations of a human body, I think it is also reasonable to consider whether regaining a physical body is really the highest state that we can attain. I hope you're seeing these slides. I'm continuing on, moving on with them. The concept of an individual physical resurrection and an embodied God also relates to the concept of multiple gods in Mormonism. Lorenzo Snow made the well-known statement, "As man is, God once was. As God now is, man may be." This implies that our God the Father himself had a Father God when he lived a mortal life, and that men and women living on the earth today can become gods, like God the Father and Mother are currently. This could also be considered a form of polytheism. This teaching seems to create an infinite regression and progression of gods, looking both forward and backward in time. At least it creates a huge number of gods, thousands, millions, perhaps an infinite number of gods. The typical Mormon response to how all these gods would fit together would probably be to say that the answer has not yet been revealed. But we can certainly use reason to examine how this might be possible. Problematic. If a number of separate gods have had achieved perfection, can there be different types of perfection? If being a god is to be all-knowing, then can one god know something that another god doesn't know? Or is it possible that in a given situation that two gods might make different decisions? Or would there be only one best decision to make? Can one god keep a secret from other all-knowing gods? Is it even possible for separate perfect gods to have individual personalities? It seems to make more sense that as multiple human mortals progress toward perfection and godhood, they would begin to join a common perfect mind that knows everything, aside from being individuals. And this is one place, again, where the Eastern philosophy comes in, and it's interesting to kind of contrast this way of thinking with the Mormon way. It is also possible that an embodied God is one of a number of individual gods who exist in a higher state of glory than mortals, but is not himself the highest state of ultimate reality in the universe. We discussed how our human bodies are composed of trillions of cells with individual life and colonized with trillions of bacteria. Could the human body be a metaphor for a universe of life, all acting together? Could God even be the sum total of trillions of individual lives? We can learn about God through the descriptions of theophany in the scriptures. Isaiah saw God as the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. Ezekiel saw God as the likeness of a man sitting on his throne, whose body was the color of amber and fire and the brightness of the rainbow. Paul experienced God as a voice coming from a great shining light out of heaven, which he also later described as an appearance of Jesus Christ. Moses in the book of Exodus experienced God as a voice calling out of a burning bush. In the book of Moses, in the Pearl of Great Price, Moses saw God face to face and talked with him. We have all heard Joseph Smith's description of the vision of the Father of the Son, which I should point out is called the first vision, not the first visitation. In the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna described God in these words, "O Lord, I see within your body all the gods and every kind of living creature. I see infinite mouths and arms, stomachs and eyes, and you are embodied in every form. I see you everywhere, without beginning, middle, or end. You wear a crown and carry a mace and discus. Your radiance is blinding and immeasurable. I see you who are so difficult to behold, shining like a fiery sun, blazing in every direction. The sun and moon are your eyes, and your mouth is fire. Your radiance warms the cosmos. O Lord, your presence fills the heavens and the earth and reaches in every direction. I can see your eyes shining with open mouth. You glitter in an array of colors and your body touches the sky. In all these accounts, both in the Bible and in the Bhagavad Gita, God is described in both human terms and also with descriptions which surpass the human form. Perhaps God presents himself in a glorified human form because that is the form that humans can understand. Mormons often pay more attention to Joseph Smith's statement of having a body and flesh and bones in D&C 130, a section not canonized in Joseph's lifetime, than they do with section 88, which Joseph called the olive leaf and is spoken of in the voice of Jesus Christ, and speaks of Christ not in a body of flesh and bones, but in a more formless, omnipresent sense. These verses in D&C 88, especially at the beginning of the section, say that Jesus Christ, a resurrected being, is he who comprehendeth all things, that he might be in and through all things, the light of truth. He is in the sun, the moon, the stars, and the earth. He doesn't communicate with a voice using vocal cords. He communicates through a light, which light proceedeth forth from the presence of God to fill the immensity of space, a light which enlightens our eyes and quickens our understanding. Which organ of a human body can project this type of light? Clearly, God's greatest power comes not from the organs of a body in flesh and bones, but from a power beyond a human body. Is it a contradiction that the God who sitteth upon his throne is also in the midst of all things? Or is God sitting on his throne metaphorical and symbolic? This is all summarized in verse 41 of D&C 88. He comprehendeth all things, and all things are before him, and all things are round about him. And he is above all things, and in all things, is through all things, and is round and about, and is round about all things. And all things are by him and of him, and even God, forever and ever. The God described here has perception that goes beyond the five senses of the mortal body, senses that can detect things at any distance. God's power is not projected by voice and hands, but through a light by which all things in the universe are governed. One of the best ways to reconcile the concept of an embodied God may be through physics. Quantum theory teaches that light can exist in both a wave and particle form, as can all matter and energy. This theory has been proven using the double slit experiment. A couple of Mormon authors have postulated that God himself could exist in both wave and particle form, with the particle form being a physical body. This conception allows God to have the aspect of a physical body, but without the restrictions of a body. This would allow God to appear in mortality in human form to communicate with his children on earth. In this sense, the main use of a body for God might be to communicate with us and to have empathy for us and to be, among other things, the God who weeps. God could appear in a vision or could be born on earth as an avatar. Or maybe we are all, in a sense, avatars of God. We each have the spark of divinity within us. Perhaps the God who weeps communicates to his children through each of us as we reach out to each other. Perhaps we are really God's hands. Another model to consider is the concept of non-duality taught by Eastern systems such as Advaita Vedanta of the Vedic tradition. This philosophy teaches that Brahman, or God, is a non-dual ultimate reality that includes everything. In our world, we experience an illusion of separateness called Maya. This might be analogous to the veil of forgetfulness. Being veiled from our oneness with everything allows us to experience ourselves as separate individuals in mortality. The individual gods of Hinduism are symbolic representations of different aspects of ultimate reality. It is taught that God may come to earth as an avatar, such as Vishnu, coming to earth as Krishna, or other avatars. Jesus Christ would also be considered an avatar. The concept of non-duality is perhaps a more robust and inclusive system that takes into account many of the questions that have been raised in this talk. How could we reconcile the Mormon and non-dual systems? Briefly, a non-dual God may have wanted to create separateness in order to experience something beyond oneness. After all, how can you understand what it is like to be one until you have experienced what it is like to be separate? made himself into matter with the illusion of separateness. As more, and in fact, embodying in each of us, and that's how we experience separateness. As mortals on earth who are experiencing what it is like to be separate, our task is now to return again to the oneness. It is my view that Mormonism can fit nicely into the non-dual system. In some ways, non-duality might even be the ultimate expression of Mormon thought. I'll just review some of the possible interpretations of God having a human, a physical human body. These interpretations are not mutually exclusive. One, God has a very literal, immortal, glorified human body with all of our functioning body systems. Two, God has a physical body in human form, but not utilizing many of the mortal organ systems that we do. Three, God is a formless spirit who can materialize in the human body at will when she presents herself to mortals. Four, God is a formless spirit that takes on a physical form when he comes to earth, such as Jesus Christ or possibly other avatars such as Krishna. Or five, as mortals, we are all avatars of God, in the sense that God can do her work through our hands as we minister to others. So how is the discussion of an embodied God helpful for us at this time in our mortal life? Why do we even want to know about God? Or is it a purely academic exercise? Or do we want to know about God so that we will better understand the purpose of our own lives? How can understanding God help us to find answers to the big questions of life? Questions such as, is there a reason that I was created and that I exist on the earth? Is there a God or a higher intelligence that is aware of me? Was this world created by chance, or does God or some form of ultimate reality have a purpose in the world's creation? Let's look at the different methods we could use to try to understand the nature of God and to seek answers to these questions. One, we can learn from the teachings of others, including church leaders and prophets. Two, we can observe the life of other people and observe the world around us and learn about God through that. Or number three, we can look deep inside ourselves. There may be a place for each of these methods. We will discuss how the third method, looking inside ourselves, relates to the ideas of this talk. The via negativa can be a method for us to examine ourselves, to see what we can subtract to get down to our deepest self. Know that this is similar to the questions we use to examine the nature of an embodied God earlier in this talk. I can first ask the question, is my physical body my deepest self? If I lose an arm or a leg, am I 5 or 10% less of a person? Our body is constantly changing with a continual turnover of cells and atoms. Does this really change who I am? In meditation, I can observe my body, also my thoughts, emotions, desires, and fears. Who is the inner observer who is able to contemplate these things? In meditation, I can watch my thoughts come and go from minute to minute, while the inner observer remains the same. Likewise, we can observe and subtract other things from ourselves. At the deepest level, I am not my life story and circumstances. I am not my occupation or other life roles. I am not my hobbies and interests or a list of church callings held. At the deepest level, I'm not my own name, my birth heritage, or maybe even my gender, because these are all things that I can observe. Is it possible that as we subtract all these qualities of mortal life, that the inner observer that is left is closer to our true deepest self or even to God? Mormonism teaches us that at our deepest, most basic level, we are an intelligence, or that we have a divine nature. Teaching that we are each a child of God implies the seed of Godhood within each of us, not just in the future, but currently. This corresponds with the Vedic teaching that the deepest self within us is the Atma, or spirit of divinity, or spark of divinity. Each Atma is a part of Brahman, which represents God, or ultimate reality. And like a fractal or a hologram, each Atma contains the whole of Brahman, meaning that deep within ourselves, each of us resides ultimate reality. The inner pathway is a journey to know ourselves on the deepest level, to understand the purpose of our lives. It may be that understanding ourselves and gaining a perception of God and of ultimate reality go hand in hand, helping us to better understand the big questions of life, including the concept of Dharma, which is finding our purpose and duty in life. So in conclusion, I've tried to make the following points in this talk. I've actually added one more, I think, to this slide. The first one, we can seek to understand the nature of God using the method of subtraction by examining which purported attributes of God might not make sense. It is helpful to describe what God is not as well as what God is. Two, the human body is designed for mortal earth-like conditions, and we can question how a human-type body might be useful for a God to have outside of mortal conditions. And let's see, Three, God presenting in human form may be a powerful way to communicate with us in mortality. Four, our own body can be a vehicle to understand our deepest self and to understand God. It may be that the Mormon concept of an embodied God is correct if fully understood. The ways that it makes sense and the ways that the parts fit together are beyond our current understanding. But I think that we can do much better than just thinking of the embodied Mormon God in a simplistic way, without considering questions and factors such as those I have suggested here. I am not trying to promote any idea as the correct way to think. I'm only suggesting ways to approach seeking to understand the nature of God and of our deepest self. The interpretations I've given are my own, and I hope you will find your own interpretations of these concepts. These ideas I have presented do not require belief or faith, but suggest experiments and meditation practices that may help us to personally experience a deeper understanding of ourselves and of God. I hope that this talk will be food for thought for each of you to better understand these important concepts. These are things I'm still trying to understand in my own life, and this talk is just one point in my journey, but I'm hoping that I'll learn more about this and continue to learn about these things as I continue to seek truth. I wish each of you well on your spiritual journey. I would be happy to hear your comments. You can reach me at ben.heaton@att.net. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Ben. We have a couple of excellent comments from the attendees that are here today. Oh, let me get myself off of, so you can see me while be part of me. There we go. The first is, how can we change the narrative going forward? Perhaps in the gospel regarding the corporeal nature of God, which has been so heavily emphasized in the Orthodox Church teachings.
I'm trying to do that with this talk for one thing, but I think you have to be patient with people. You can't just go out and say, you guys are wrong, I'm right. You have to be strategic. You have to learn how to incorporate church teachings. Like I mentioned, DNC 88, that's the olive leaf. That's like one of our main scriptures that talks about a formless God who is within all things. So, I think you need to use Mormon sources and even the scriptures and say, hey, wait a minute, this talks about a body, a God that goes beyond just being in a body. This God is within everything. So I think if you use Mormon sources, take things slowly and just realize you have to do it kind of one person at a time, or one group of people at a time, and we each do our little parts, and we can't change the whole world, but we can sometimes help people around us to have a better understanding.
Yeah, very, very important. Okay, so another question that we've had is that having God having been previously immortal like us, was something that this commenter could connect with, and also that he could be a god. So, but the double-edged sword there that the commenter is mentioning is that, that if he could become a god, then that means that in order to become a god, I would have to become perfect. Have you read much about that? I know perfection is something that we have a great deal of complication analyzing in the church. Worrying about perfection, making sure, trying to improve ourselves.
Right. I mean, all I can say to that, the perfection part is, that may be that may not be the ultimate truth, and I would try to look beyond that. I try to make the point in the talk that, you know, God having being immortal, like the question said, does help us to connect with God. But that with being perfect is a completely different question. You know, why don't we just connect with God and not worry about the perfection part, but you know, think about the aspect of God that understands us and loves us. You know, that's the God we need to connect with, not some God that doesn't love us, that is different than us. You know, I guess if God has a body, somehow God is more in common with us than different. God may be at a higher state, but it's just like a father and child, you know, there's only love and teaching and wanting us to be better. You know, this idea of perfection and judgment, I don't know, that to me doesn't really fit in with the way I think.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you. Another has asked, if spirit is matter, as Joseph Smith taught, it seems like much of these questions would apply to our spiritual bodies as well. How does a material spiritual body affect the conversation of God, or affect this conversation discussing ourselves and God?
Well, that's an interesting question. And again, I'm using sort of this negative theology of thinking, like, for example, a spirit body. Why would a spirit body need a digestive system and to eat, you know? So bodies are designed for an earth environment. So a spirit body, the idea that a spirit body has an immune system, you know, that it has a turnover of cells, that it's made up of cells, that it has, you know, it's just, it doesn't make sense, you know? And I think we have to learn to sort of subtract out some of the things that don't seem to make sense. So I'm not saying that there are not spirit bodies, and maybe it's in the form of a body, and I'm not saying that's wrong, but I'm saying it is valid to question that. And how does that make sense? I'm not saying that we didn't exist before this life. We may very well have, but we all sort of anthropomorphize everything sometimes. And maybe we just need to look deeper at this and think, well, maybe we need to reframe a spirit body into more of a metaphorical sense. So these are things we can all think about. I'm just trying to sort of generate thought. I'm not saying I have all the answers.
We understand.
Some of these narratives and how they don't seem to make sense, and why don't we maybe look beyond them? And to me, it's just exciting because it opens up new avenues of thought and of exploration. We don't have to be tied down to this rigid Mormon theology. We can really be free to examine the world around us, free to think whatever we want, and really free ourselves and see what makes sense to us and really allow ourselves to believe, you know, something on a deeper level and independently.
Awesome, thank you. I'm gonna ask this one next because it seems to go along with the one that we were just discussing, because we were discussing physical bodies and spiritual bodies, this being kind of related to it. What does it mean to be transfigured? Presumably not to become a god with a perfect body, but would it be a related process? Is there something in there that is interconnected?
Well, again, that kind of gets into a lot of what I talked about, and it's one of these things we don't know, and that's kind of the negative theology thing, is you're not saying this is how it is. You're saying, look, these are some problematic areas that don't make sense. Let's subtract those out and see what we have left. So Christ, obviously, he was resurrected. He came, you know, in the New Testament talks him being on earth and eating and being with people. So does that mean he stayed in a physical body and that's all he was? Well, maybe not. Maybe yes, maybe no. Maybe, you know, I talked about in physics how God could be in waveform and particle form. Well, maybe God can materialize in a body. And if you read Autobiography of a Yogi by Yogananda, he talks about kind of an Eastern spirituality, and he even had his guru Sri Yukteswar appeared to him after he had died and told him, I have materialize this body to come and talk to you. So you may or may not believe right. that, but I'm just saying there are different ways to look at it. And I think the idea that God is just stuck in this physical body and is limited by a body and is not, you know, a power that fills the universe, that just, to me, that doesn't seem to make sense. So we have to try to subtract what doesn't make sense and then see what's left and maybe consider other alternatives. I hope that answer, at least, you know, I can't say this is how it is, but I hope that gives some ideas to think about.
Well, I think it was a very fascinating presentation because I tend to think about God in those facets as well, specifically because I figure that science is God's way of doing things, so it must apply. Physics applies to the universe. We have one more question, and that is, how would classical Mormon and process theology concept of a limited God, would it resolve many of the issues that are raised that we have in the church in general, or is it just, how would that be an effect to what we're discussing?
You know, that's another interesting question. You know, process theology, Dan Weatherspoon wrote a really interesting doctoral thesis on that, it's worth reading. I think from that, I kind of talked about, made the idea that maybe the idea that God, there's this higher state than us, that's higher above us, that is a higher level of glory, but it's maybe not ultimate reality. So to me, I guess where the Eastern philosophy, the kind of the non-dual system goes beyond that and where it kind of differs from process theology, I think, is because process theology kind of acts in time, whereas non-duality is beyond time and space. It's like an ultimate reality that exists beyond everything, and then lower things appear. This oneness, this eternal, unchanging oneness, manifests itself into the physical world as physical matter and people and objects in the world. And it's really interesting, the whole kind of Eastern Vedic philosophy really, as I said, is kind of a robust system that deals with all this and some of the different gods, you know, gods that may be aspects of ultimate reality. There may be a god of process theology that is something somewhere between non-duality and mortality that exists, and that would certainly fit within sort of the Eastern way of thinking. And it would, to me, that would fit in the Mormon way too, that the God the Father, God the Mother are somewhere between non-duality and mortality. They're a higher state than us, maybe something like process theology, but there is still an ultimate reality that includes everything, every bit of matter, every bit of energy in the universe, and it's beyond time and space. So there's an ultimate reality that exists beyond all of that. And that helps solve the problem of multiple gods. You know, how do all these billions of gods that we're all going to become fit together? We have to eventually, as different gods reach perfection, you think they would all reach the same perfection. It only makes sense that as they perfect themselves, they all come to have one mind and eventually, you know, one understanding where they all incorporate everything. And so we're each like a fractal or hologram. We each incorporate all of reality, and we're veiled from that now, but deep within us, the idea is that ultimate reality is deep within all of us.
Oh, very cool. I did actually, I had another question come in, and now I have misplaced it because apparently that's what I'm doing today. Give me one moment. All right. This question is, Dennis Potter argues that Mormons have gone too far in saying God has a physical body, but is subject to none of the laws of physics, or as you point out, biology, as we understand them, not subject to gravity, unlimited in time and space, emitting light, surviving with a fatal wound, etc. At what point do we need to give up the physical descriptor? And I personally would add, and what could we use in exchange for it, or other thoughts that you have on that line?
Well, I think, you know, when we as Mormons are ready, we have to be willing to look beyond. I hope I showed in my talk that we can, there's a lot of beauty in the Mormon concept of God, the God who weeps. You don't have to give all that up to move beyond that and realize, yeah, maybe there's a, you peel off that layer of the onion and there's a deeper layer that, that we can look at, and we don't need to limit ourselves. So yeah, I think that this, you know, it's paradoxical. You know, as I said, the deepest truth is paradoxical. It can't be reconciled by mortal understanding. So there, you know, there is a physical element of God, and there's an element of God that goes beyond physical, and it's hard to put that into words. So, but again, hopefully my talk has, you know, raised some of the questions that this questioner asked, you know, some of the things we discussed, and it's just something we can all think about, you know. Now, if this, you know, if you enjoyed the talk and these ideas have made sense, now it's your turn to figure this out for yourself, you know, and you can figure this out as good as anyone else. Just going forward, just look at the world around you, look at other people, look at church teachings, and try to just open your mind and, you know, look at Eastern spirituality and figure out for yourselves what you believe and what you think makes most sense.
And, thank you so much.
If you learn meditation, that's kind of what I described. That's a great practice that kind of helps us to do all this.
No, I appreciate it. Thank you so much. This was a great session and very fascinating. We have some requests that you would make your PowerPoints and your talk of maybe available. So we'll find a way to do that if you're agreeable to it.
Oh, I would, yeah. And again, if, my email address is ben.heaton@att.net. I'd be happy to, meet with, discuss this with people. And if you have any other questions, I think it's a really interesting topic. So feel free to email me. And if you're interested, if no other way, we'll figure out a way to get the talk to you if you're interested.
I think there's a way to make it possible on Whova, and I will ask about that after. We are like 5 minutes over, so I'm gonna get in trouble. It's fine. Grace won't be too mad. Thank you so much for being with us today. And Ben, this was great and really fascinating, and we had some great questions come from it. And thank you, everybody, for attending.
Yeah, best wishes to all of you, and hope you enjoyed this, and thank you for listening.
Yep. Have a wonderful afternoon, and have a good lunchtime. Bye.